I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the serial entrepreneur Jack Dorsey. He's the co-founder of Twitter, a social networking media service launched in 2006. Twitter has over 500 million users internationally. The company gained global recognition when it facilitated the Iranian protests of the presidential election in 2009. Jack is also the co-founder of Square, a mobile payments company that allows any merchant to accept payments through a device that plugs into their smartphone's headphone jack. The company started by working with micro-merchants or small business owners who didn't traditionally have the ability to accept credit cards, but it has grown rapidly to include other services and larger businesses, such as Starbucks, as well. Jack is a former massage therapist. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with your personal life because I think it helps to inform the choices that you've made later on. You grew up in Missouri, in St. Louis, and you had a particularly close relationship with your parents, especially your mother. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, my parents have a very interesting story. And my father, when he was 19 years old, started a pizza restaurant with his best friend, and they called it Two Nice Guys. The business started doing very, very well, and they needed to hire help, and they wanted to preserve their friendship and also the business. So they made one rule between the two best friends, which is they would not date the waitstaff. And the first person they hired was my mother. My father fell in love with my mother and went to his best friend and said, "I broke the rule. The business is yours." And I was born 10 months later. Hmm. So my parents have always had this edge of entrepreneurship. My mom later started a coffee store in St. Louis called Shenandoah Coffee. Mm-hmm. And my father has had a small business around medical devices for over 25 years. Mm-hmm. So I've learned a lot about starting small and starting one's own business from them.
Obviously, you observe them being very entrepreneurial. But what about emotionally? How was your relationship with them?
It was great. You know, they always pushed me to explore new things. And I had a very meandering, wandering path throughout my life. And that was always something that was that was loved and accepted. But I think technology, especially Twitter, has really deepened our relationship.
Why is that?
Because when we first started Twitter, we got a lot of critique about it being used to talk about what one is having for breakfast, for instance. You know, to 99.9999% of the world, updates like that are useless. But my mother loves it. She loves knowing that I'm eating breakfast every day, and she loves knowing that I'm alive. And it's these little things in life, these small details, that really bind us. We always know what's going on in each other's lives.
It's ironic that you say Twitter's brought you closer because you focus on the mundane aspects of your day, because that's exactly what Twitter has been criticized for. Like, who cares about that? And it's actually just that which has been the most important in your usage of it, vis-a-vis your mom, at least.
I believe so. And also for public figures that we often put on pedestals. You know, one of the most compelling moments for me was watching on the campaign trail in 2008, President Barack Obama talking about what he had for breakfast or just little details of his day. And I think that adds so much context that it rehumanizes people.
Technology was an important part of your life, you know, even when you were 7, 8, 9 years old, and you had a particular interest in maps. Why were you drawn to maps so much, and how did technology tie in?
My parents always loved the city. I just loved the energy. I loved the dynamic range, how electric it felt. So in order to understand a city better, I developed this fascination with maps, maps of New York, maps of St. Louis. My parents bought a computer in 1984, Macintosh, when I was 8 years old, and I just fell in love with that technology as well, because you could see things move around, and it wasn't just a static map, but I could actually start programming them, and I could teach myself, and I did teach myself how to draw maps on the computer, and then to draw dots moving around the map, and then constrain them within streets, and then I had all these dots moving around this map, and I thought it was the most beautiful thing in the world, but the dots had no meaning whatsoever. So my parents had a police scanner. They had a CB radio. We lived right next to the highway, so I heard all this activity. And if you listen to an ambulance or a police car or a fire truck, they're always reporting where they are, what they're doing, and where they're going. So, and I could use that as input for my programs that I was writing to attribute meaning to one of those dots. And I could actually simulate its path throughout the city, which was amazing because suddenly I could see the city living and breathing, and I added more and more dimensions, taxis, black cars, couriers, and I eventually learned that this entire practice had a name and an industry, which was called dispatch. Mm. So I made it my life to go after and write dispatch software and find the biggest dispatch firm in the world, which happened to be here in New York City.
You were engrossed in programming from an early age. What were you like socially at school? What was your reputation?
I was more quiet than not. I went to all Catholic school for most of my life until university. I really loved drawing.
While you seem to have had a very nurturing, loving home environment, you had dreadlocks, you had blue hair, you listened to punk rock, you had this nose ring. You have a big tattoo on your forearm. Do you have any other tattoos?
I have a tattoo of a star on my ankle.
You have one on your ankle. Yep. Now, is this just emblematic of, you know, the typical turmoil of adolescence, or was there more going on?
Well, I like experimenting a lot, and I'm somewhat impulsive. So when I decide to do something, I pretty much go all in. So I had dreadlocks when I first moved to San Francisco, and I listened to a lot of punk rock just because I liked the attitude. There was an attitude in punk rock which really mirrored hacker culture, which was you don't have to be perfect at performing, you don't have to be perfect at an instrument. You take a guitar and you get out there.
And it seems like that's what you've done with Square in a way. You had no background in financial services, but you said, you know what, let's just take my guitar and get out there.
Yeah, yeah. You drive more by principle of what do you want to see in the world. Mm. And you do whatever it takes to make sure that happens.
Incidentally, you refused to learn how to drive as well.
Yeah, I was a big fan of public transit because I thought it was core to cities.
The style that you carried, the dreadlocks and the nose ring, et cetera, are particularly striking given the way you look today. Short hair, very clean shaven, sort of, actually, not really,
yeah.
And just very dapper. So you seem to have jumped into now this new style.
Well, I mean, we raised our first round at Twitter with a tattoo and a nose ring. It doesn't change people's perception of you that much. It was really about the merit of video, and that's what I loved about it.
You now run and meditate and eat well. Have you always been mindful of your health and fitness?
When I was a kid, I developed this fascination with walking through my Aunt Eileen. She would walk all the time, and that was really my first form, although I didn't know what I was doing, of meditation, because that's where I really go to when I want to think about something or think through something or just get away. I take a walk.
Did you run today?
No, I did exercise. I do exercise every day.
What did you do?
Just simple stuff, jumping jacks, jump rope, sit-ups, and push-ups.
In your hotel room?
In my hotel room.
And you think you're alone. You're like, I'm the only one doing this. But actually...
No, I know I'm not alone.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jack Dorsey, co-founder of the social networking company Twitter, and Square, the mobile payments company. Jack eats two hard-boiled eggs with soy sauce every morning. You left University of Missouri during college and moved to New York City. And this is after you hacked the system of a public company called DMS, Dispatch Management Service. And the CEO was impressed and said, come to New York. Mm-hmm. So you transferred to NYU and you ended up working for this company. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was great. So I always wanted to work in dispatch. I always wanted to live in Manhattan. And I found the biggest dispatch firm in the world, which was DMS. I found that they had this hole in their web server, and I emailed them, here's how you fix it. And I was flown out, and within a week, I had a job. And we decided to move to San Francisco. in 1999 and start a more web-focused dispatch company.
In addition, you also started together with Greg Kidd, the founder of the company, an e-commerce software company that offered same-day deliveries. And it struck me that this was very early days and really the nascent stages of e-commerce. And the company was called DNet, and it ultimately didn't work out. Do you think it was just timing?
I think it was timing. It was also we didn't really put the emphasis on engineering. We had very, very few engineers and a lot of salespeople, and it was just out of balance. Also, we built the company at the same time the entire bubble was about to burst. I learned a lot from that experience. That was the first company that I really pushed and built. I was a founder, but I wasn't running any of the company, and that's one of the things that I took away from it.
During this time, you know, moved to San Francisco, your first startup did not go well. You had random programming jobs. You built a dispatching service for the ferry service going to Alcatraz, among other systems. You became a massage therapist. You took sewing classes. This is all in the spirit of exploration. But was there any jitteriness of feeling like, okay, my motor's really turning, but I'm really not making palpable linear progress?
No, I never saw it that way. You know, programming is an art and a craft that you stay in your head a lot. You're not really working with your hands. Your hands are on the keyboard, but it's all mental. Every time I felt overwhelmed with that, I wanted to do something more with my hands. And I had all these kind of meandering paths to allow me to be more tangible. My first was botanical illustration, and I went back to programming, and then I started developing RSI, carpal tunnel, and I do have this tendency to want to learn something and go all into it. And,
as you said before.
as I said before, and my friend suggested that I get a massage, and I said, oh, I got a massage, and it actually helped me, and I said, why not just learn how to do this myself? So I took 1,000 hours of massage therapy and learned everything about the body. But then went back to programming because I always have this draw to create through that medium, and did the same thing with sewing and denim specifically, because I love denim because it takes on the wear of someone's life. But eventually went back to programming.
By the way, my husband has this motto, nihil in moderado, which is nothing in moderation. You should like tattoo that on your other arm.
Or everything in moderation.
Perhaps.
Nothing is everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jack Dorsey, co-founder of Twitter and the financial services company Square. We'll hear more from Jack coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the internet entrepreneur Jack Dorsey. He's the founder of Twitter, the social media company that allows users to send messages using no more than 140 characters. He's also the founder of the mobile payments company Square. Other names considered for Square were seashells, an early currency people used to exchange goods, and squirrel, the idea being that people gather funds from others in the same way that squirrels gather acorns. In 2005, you got a more traditional job at a company called Odeo, which was a podcast directory company, which ultimately didn't do well because iTunes came out with their service. And through this turmoil, you developed Twitter, although the seeds for Twitter were kind of in your back pocket in 2000 when you initially had the idea for something that became Twitter. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what that germ was in 2000? Briefly?
Well, leading from dispatch, you know, I had this beautiful picture of the city, but I was missing the people. And I was a big fan of instant messenger as well, especially around statuses. So I'm on a call, I'm in a meeting, I'm listening to this particular song. So the idea was to be able to take something small like that and to take it anywhere. And I had the first BlackBerry device, the RIM 850. And I coded up I programmed a little service that took an email from that device, and it would send it out to all my friends. And I was living in San Francisco at the time. I went to Golden Gate Park. There's a bison paddock with bison roaming around in Golden Gate Park in the middle of the city. And I went there, and I said, I'm at the bison paddock in Golden Gate Park. And it was sent out to all my friends via email, and I quickly learned that number one, no one cared, and number two, no one else had a BlackBerry device. It was an interesting idea, but it was ahead of its time a bit, and the technology just was not there.
The technology wasn't there until 2006.
So in 2006, sure enough, I was introduced to SMS at Odeo, and SMS, short messaging service, text messages, which is a beautiful technology. I fell in love with it. It had this great constraint of 160 characters. It worked on every single phone out there. The idea came back up. What if we just took text messaging and we enabled anyone to text a service, and then it would go out to all the people that cared about it?
You mentioned that you like the constraint of 160 characters of texting. You've always seemed to have an appreciation for minimalism. Growing up, your mom said that when you moved into your new home, you chose the smallest room, and you had two younger brothers.
I don't like having a lot of stuff. I don't like carrying around a lot. I like a lot of simplicity, and really just comes down to not having to carry much in the world. So I'm a person who, you know, when I find a watch, it's going to be the watch for the rest of my life. And when I find a bag, you know, I'll keep it for 15, 20 years.
Now, was your love of these 160 characters, you think, consistent with your minimalism? Or why did you love the 160?
I love the 160 because I do like constraint. If I give you a paintbrush and I tell you to go paint this huge canvas I have on the wall, it's somewhat intimidating, and you're going to be very thoughtful and composed about it. If I give you that same paintbrush and I give you the back of a business card and tell you to make a mark, you'll make a mark. So there's something interesting about making the canvas size small and making it more approachable. And then it becomes more of the moment, becomes more expressive, and every mark, therefore, is beautiful and useful to someone. I was not someone who really enjoyed blogging because the format was just too long and unconstrained, whereas with 160 characters, which we then pulled down to 140 characters, there was a nice constraint, and I could be more of the moment, and there was more creativity because I had to fit it all in.
Why did you then pick 140 characters for Twitter? Was that arbitrary?
Well, there are two reasons. The 160 was purely practical in the sense that we wanted to work on every device out there. So a $5 cell phone in the middle of Kenya could also receive a message from anywhere in the world. And also that constraint inspires creativity concept. So we took 20 characters out for a username and for some syntax, and we arrived at 140 characters.
And Twitter, the name, the definition is inconsequential bursts of information.
Yes, yes, and chirps from birds.
Right. Yeah. And some other names you flirted with, Jitter and Twitch.
Twitch.
Right.
They don't bring up the best imagery.
Mm. So at the time, you were working with Ev Williams and Biz Stone, who had worked at a company called Blogger, sold to Google. And you were made CEO. And prior to that, you were a contractor for mm-hmm. them. Why did they think that you should be CEO? You were very young. You had no leadership experience. By the way, I should mention Noah Glass was involved
yes.
as well.
So Noah was the co-founder of Odeo, and Ev was the CEO. And as soon as iTunes launched the directory, the company became directionless. So brought up the idea for Twitter, and we built it in 2 weeks. And the first tweet was actually inviting coworkers, which were inviting my coworkers from Odeo to join me. And you know, the reason that I became CEO is because I was leading the product and I was leading the direction, and it made sense. And we had about 7 people at that time.
And how are you feeling at the time? You know, you were programming, but you were also managing. Were you like, okay, like I'm owning this, I'm good at it?
It wasn't really something that I thought about. I thought about just building the product. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that you had to manage necessarily. I actually think managing is somewhat of a reactive word. It's something like I have to manage the situation versus coach
editing
or build.
Or editing.
Editing is another good one. So very particular about the words that we use in the companies, and I think that sets the tone for everything.
What were your ambitions for Twitter? How much of an impact did you think it would have?
Was is fairly selfish. I wanted to go back to that idea of maps, and I wanted to see the world. I wanted to see how the world was feeling. I wanted to see what it was doing.
Were you surprised when President Obama adopted it for his town halls, and the Iranian protesters used it to the extent that the U.S. State Department asked you to keep the service running when you were going to do a maintenance, and Rupert Murdoch's using it? Talk to me about your level of surprise or...
Well, every day there's a new surprise and something that we find really, really delightful about how people are using it. So people tweet by tweet change how they think about it and how the world thinks about the service. And that, to me, shows something that's going to last, because it's like electricity. It's something that we don't really think about unless we're talking about it, mm-hmm. unless it goes down. Otherwise, we plug in a microwave oven, we plug in an electric guitar, a keyboard, a seat warmer, whatever. But it's always there. It's always useful. And we can have all these different experiences based on how we perceive it and based on how we use it.
Ev Williams asked you to leave as CEO. Was that a surprise to you, or what was your reaction?
Well, we switched roles. So Ev really wanted to be CEO, and he was our chairman, and I became chairman, and he became CEO. So it was a different, certainly different perspective. It was surprising and also freeing at the same time.
You seem very measured and unflappable, but is that really, like, I'd love to just dig into your emotional state. Was it like, okay, well, that's disappointing, but
oh, no,
it's
no,
a
no.
blessing?
No, it was a hard departure. You know, it was something that I loved, that I've been thinking about since I was a kid, and to not be as directly involved was certainly extremely, extremely challenging and devastating for me for quite some time. But you have to get over it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jack Dorsey, the co-founder of the social networking company Twitter, and Square, a mobile payments company that, among other attributes, offers a micro-merchant payment acceptance service that allows any business owner to accept payments from customers. Merchants are charged a flat 2.75% for each transaction, which is lower than the typical fee that payment processors have historically charged. The company offers Square Register, which turns mobile devices into a point-of-sale system, providing inventory management, customer tracking, and other business analytics. Square Wallet allows customers to buy products, such as Starbucks coffee, without having to use their actual credit card. You founded Square with a partner, Jim McKelvey, who is a glassblower, mm-hmm. and he was your first boss in Missouri. You worked for him as one of your odd jobs, mm-hmm. helping him with his back office maintenance,
yeah.
essentially.
Yeah.
How did you and Jim come to the idea of Square?
Jim is a glassblower. He kind of departed engineering. He was building companies before, and that's a company I work for. And he really got into glassblowing, and he was doing it, and he was selling these glass faucets for and pieces of glass, and he would sell them for $2,000 a piece. And one day, someone called him up and wanted to buy one, but he couldn't accept a credit card. He couldn't accept an Amex card, and he lost a sale because of it. 90% of this country, at least, is paying with plastic: debit cards, credit cards, prepaid cards. So if you don't accept plastic, you miss out on sales. People go elsewhere. So we just found it funny that one could not just download an app today and start accepting credit cards. And we decided to take a month and to figure out if we could build a system around it.
Now, you had been noodling on other ideas prior to choosing to move forward with Square. One other idea he had was to build an electric car company.
Yes, we were looking at everything. I actually wasn't looking at finance much at all, because I really have no basis for it. I don't understand it.
You launched at an auspicious time, ironically. It was in 2008, at the time of the crash. Can you describe that a little more?
Yeah, there were a lot of auspicious pointers to what we were doing. First, I was living across the street from the U.S. Mint in San Francisco.
Coincidentally.
Which is a very auspicious location to start a payments company, and it's purely coincidence. There's no better time to create something than in a depression or a recession, because people are resetting. They're a little bit more willing to take a look at new things.
Although, venture capitalists might not feel like it's a very favorable time. People are, keeping their wallets close. You know, people thought, oh, you're the Twitter guy. You know, this is random to do financial services. What do you think convinced them?
Showing them the product. So, the best thing was we built this system in a month and we could start accepting credit cards. And they said, wow. Mm-hmm. So, I did approach a lot of VCs and investors with this idea, and they did push back. You worked on quote-unquote microblogging. You worked on something that people used to talk about what they had for breakfast. Why do you think you can move billions of dollars around in a financial market.
What role did the Golden Gate Bridge have in just, you know, being wallpaper, to helping to influence your motivation, if any?
Absolutely. We live in a very fortunate area in San Francisco, and we look to the Golden Gate Bridge all the time because it's not just the end product that is gorgeous and amazing and iconic. And a wonder, but also the way they built it. They built it in 1934. They gave themselves 5 years. They built it in 3 years. Only 1,300 people worked on the bridge. They did it with $33 million, which is about $1.2 billion in today's money. Mm. So epic scale. And it's a 1.7-mile span across one of the most tumultuous areas on the West Coast. And then there's earthquakes. It's the last place on the planet that you want to build a bridge. So, you know, at its very core, a bridge is utility. It gets people from point A to point B. And at its very core, Square and Twitter is a utility. It gets either communication from point A to point B or money from point A to point B. And they have a lot of parallels. And if it does that well, it disappears. But if people really notice it, it's something that is breathtaking and they appreciate it. So we want to build something that is similar to that idea.
Along those lines, the Square's card reader was inducted into the Museum of Modern Art's archive in 2011.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Skeuomorphism?
Yes.
What is that?
Skeuomorphism is a practice and designed to through digital interfaces to refer to real interfaces. I think there's a great balance of referencing something that we know as we go into something new, which is digital. And that's what we're trying to do at Square. A lot of our products reference real objects because it establishes trust. It's an opening. With Square Register, the thing actually looks like a paper pad and we have a page turn as you're ripping off a ticket. Square Wallet, there's references to cards. There's references to leather. Just hints at them. But that's really all it takes.
And they hint at them so that people don't feel as intimidated to try them and to adopt them.
Yeah, there's a warmth to things we know and to things we're used to.
I want to go back to the early days of Square. You saw a hole in the financial service market where micro merchants or small businesses weren't able to accept credit cards because the payments to credit card companies were just too onerous. What was Amex and MasterCard and Visa's response to your entering?
So there's 8 million entities, 8 million businesses that accept credit cards in the United States alone, but there's over 26 million small businesses who don't. So they saw it as a way to extend their network. At the end of the day, what they care about the most is removing cash and moving more to electronic payments. So they saw Square as a way to really advance that agenda.
Your first few merchants were Sightglass, which is this coffee shop in San Francisco you're an investor in, mm-hmm. as well as a florist. Mm-hmm. Who else were some of the earliest?
We had, Sightglass, which was just a coffee cart, a flower cart named Lilybell. And a flight instructor, actually, and that was it.
Starbucks was your first larger business, which has opened up a completely new array of partners for you. How did that happen? Did Howard Schultz approach you, or did you approach them? What's the story there?
Howard and Starbucks actually approached us, and they said, you know, we've been looking at a lot of payment companies, and we've been looking at really moving ahead in terms of how we're thinking about mobile payments specifically. We would love for you to come up to Seattle and tell us about Square. So we went up there and we just had a great meeting.
You, in less than a year, built the hardware and the payment network and the risk systems and the customer service and the web services, and you coordinated all these systems all from scratch, basically.
Mm-hmm. All from scratch. We built Square and made it operational in under 9 months. And then Starbucks was very similar.
So what are some hiccups that you've had in the early days? Because it seems like things have been pretty seamless.
Some of the hiccups that we saw was, you know, it took us a lot longer than normal to actually get the credit card processing infrastructure out. We had to go through a lot of regulation. So we first launched Square as a cash-only register. And people knew about Square before that, and the promise was you could accept credit cards anywhere. So the people that were really cheering for us said, you know, what's going on? And it took us another 5 months to actually roll out the credit card processing.
What about, because you're trying to do so much, you know, there's obviously a lot of competitors who are going to be innovating, and probably conventionally people might say, well, why don't you just focus on one aspect of this payment process instead of trying to build the entire system? What is your response to that?
Well, we do see it as a focus, but we see it as a different focus. Going back to the Golden Gate Bridge, if we want to build something truly magical, we have to build that entire span, right? It has to be end-to-end. So a lot of our competitors are building a credit card terminal or a point of sale or a cash register or a payment network or a bank. Or coupons, whatnot. And they're all disconnected. They're all separate companies and they're all separate systems. And when you try to, when a merchant or a buyer, a customer tries to put all these together, they don't really fit together. They're not seamless. And you start noticing the seam points. So our focus is building that entire span. Mm-hmm. And there's still a simplicity around that.
Might you be a tender type one day and replace a MasterCard or a Visa?
Well, that's not what we're optimizing for. There's certainly a potential or a reality for that. But our idea has always been we're always going to accept the payment device, the tender that comes over the counter, because that means the merchant is always getting the sale.
So going from, you know, these financial complexities to your mom, does she use Square?
She does. Just yesterday, I sent my mom a gift card from here in New York to her favorite bookstore, Left Bank Books, in the Central West End. And I sent my father a week of cappuccinos to his favorite coffee company, Sump Coffee, in the city.
And I've heard that you text or maybe tweet with your mom daily. What was the last mundane communication you had with her?
No, my mom is usually the first person that texts me in the morning, the last person that texts me every day. They just moved to a new condo that's right on the Mississippi River, so she usually sends me pictures of the sunrise or the sunset.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jack Dorsey. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They were pioneers behind making chocolate from the actual bean to the bar, and they're part of a group of food artisans who produce their own cheese and chocolate and knives and meats, and they're part of a local barter community in Williamsburg. Welcome, Michael. Welcome, Rick.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Before we get started, I just want our listeners to know what I'm looking at, which is two brothers who have massive beards. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how long it's taken you to get your beards to the length that they are.
Well, originally, we sort of made a wager with ourselves when we first decided to do this. We made a wager that after we would make and sell successfully 1,000 chocolate bars, we were not going to shave. And by the time that happened, we were sort of accustomed to them, and they were sort of part of who we are, and we thought it sort of symbolized what we do, so we keep them, much to our wives, my wife and his girlfriend's dismay.
Yeah. We held true to that, and it took about maybe 8 months before we sold our first 1,000 bars.
How would you describe what Mast Brothers Chocolate is?
Well, simply we describe it as American craft chocolate, a sort of term that goes beyond just being a slogan. Just taking pride in one's work as a craftsman or a craftswoman, you know, that it's not just for my brother and I, but it's for the people that work with us in our factory. It's also just people that work in our community, in our food artisan community, and beyond food artisan community. It's being a part of a community of furniture makers. You know, there's a resurgence in furniture makers. There's a great knife maker in Brooklyn. There's all sorts of great cheese makers, beer makers, wine makers. So whether it's, you know, from woodworking to food, it's a sort of self-dependence and a pride in what you make with your hands.
Rick, before you were making chocolate with Michael, your brother, what were you doing?
I was working in kitchens and restaurants all around New York. worked briefly at Gramercy Tavern, worked briefly at Soho House, worked briefly under Jacques Torres.
Gramercy Tavern, which is owned by Danny Meyer, the restaurateur, and Jacques Torres, he's a chocolate maker.
So what we do is make the chocolate that maybe someday he would use to make his confections with. We are the tree grower or the logger to somebody else, to a carpenter's, you know, creation of something they would make with wood, you know.
And before you were working in the culinary life, what were you doing?
Before that, I was a classical musician. I studied piano and composition and was obsessed with opera. And I always dreamt of actually using a similar approach and mentality and vision to what we're applying to chocolate with opera. I always thought that opera was the ultimate liberal arts education. That's what I'd always say. You can learn everything about life by working in an opera.
Why do you say that's the case for opera, and how is that then carried on to your making of chocolate?
Well, with opera, you're learning about languages, you're learning about history, you're learning about physical building of sets, you're learning about math with the composition of scores, you're learning so much, and you're working with the team, all of that. Well, I think that which you just learn about the necessities of life. Food, shelter, music, art, those are the things, family, friends, those are the things you need in life. So to sort of be a proponent of it that, and really push it out there to the public about how beautiful it can be and how important it is and how pure it can be, it doesn't have to be so complicated. That's important to me. I'm not sure if I made sense there, but I tried to in a roundabout kind of way.
I think it does.
Yeah.
How did you decide to go from opera to chocolate?
Well, it was opera to food, music to food. So my brother was living in New York. I was living in California at the time. And I decided to move out to New York and crashed on my brother's couch and started getting into food. Started first, just briefly worked at a local restaurant in Williamsburg, and then decided after about a week or two of that I need to study and really work at this like I worked at classical music. So then I went to culinary school.
Michael, what were you doing before starting this company?
Well, I originally came out here after I graduated from college in 2001, and my goal was to work in independent films and maybe one day be a film producer. And so my path was working in production and in financing and accounting for different films or TV shows.
You're both from Iowa. What did your parents do in Iowa?
Our mother works for the dean of the graduate college at the University of Iowa, and our father passed away a few years ago.
Yeah, our father was a carpenter, but he fought in Vietnam and went through the shit, as they say. So he had lots of problems, and our mom was always sort of a champ and raised us on her own. We have an older sister as well.
What influence did you have from them, if any, in the path you chose? I mean, yes, your father was a carpenter, so there's that obvious link with working with your hands.
Mm-hmm. And that's about it. I think that what our mother taught us was self-reliance and work ethic. I think that it goes beyond stereotype that Iowa boys work harder than everybody else. Mike and I have a sort of unwavering work ethic that we wake up, no matter how much we fought or how whatever happened in our personal lives, we'll always wake up and get the job done and work, you know, pretty devastatingly exhausting hours.
What was that moment when you both said, Rick, you're living on Michael's couch, and you said, okay, we're going to start this chocolate company. How come it wasn't cheese or milk or butter?
Well, I think that it could easily have been cheese or butter. I'm interested in all of them, and we both are interested in all of them. It was chocolate specifically because chocolate is probably far and away so associated with American culture because of such a favorite food of Americans. And so when we were searching out, we're like, oh, how is chocolate made exactly? After learning about how to make cheese and all these other things, chocolate was the next on the list. So how do you make chocolate? Well, let's go ask. So we'd go to shop after shop after shop, and they'd say, how is chocolate? I would ask them how chocolate was made, and they would say, well, we put the chocolate in this tempering machine, and then we make these, you know, various shapes or bonbons or truffles. And we're like, no, how is the chocolate made? chocolate doesn't grow on trees. It's a recipe of it's what happens after you make something. Mm-hmm. So that's when we realized, no one knows and no one is doing it in all of New York City. So we were just like, wow, this is insane.
Why do you think no one else in New York City was making chocolate from the bean?
Well, I think that from a business perspective, the profit margins aren't exactly through the roof. You could make a lot more money selling truffles and bonbons and confections than you can making it from the bean. It also, there's no such thing as commercial equipment for it. You can't say, I'm going to start a small chocolate company and then go online and get a couple machines. Almost all the machines that we started with were made for something else. For instance, our first granite stone grinder that we used was made to grind rice, and it was sourced from India. And we had to do some alterations to it for it to be used for chocolate. So it truly is a start from scratch, including the equipment.
We talk about how craftsmanlike you are, and it seems like such an ironically novel concept, you know, in the 21st century, when really you're just getting back to the very fabric of human existence. And it's amazing how far we've moved from that.
It's incredible. Yeah, people go on now. They go on Brooklyn food tours, and people come with their cameras around their necks, and they're like, "Look, these people are making chocolate from scratch. We're going to go to the butcher and watch him butcher meat." Wow, you know, it's like,
we really just wanted to simplify everything too, and that's why we're so open about what we're doing and how we have an open factory, just so people can really see what's going on. And there's no mystery behind it, or there's no mystery in the ingredients or the process.
Could you just walk me through briefly the process, how you are going from bean to bar?
We source our beans currently from Madagascar, from Brazil, from Venezuela, and from Dominican Republic. We also have a relationship with some farms in Belize. And when I mention these countries, it isn't just a country. We have specific farms from each country. After we get the beans, we actually just have a big butcher block table. We spread the beans out on there, and we sort through them by hand. We literally go through each bean, and any piece of bark, any piece of just empty husk, any stone, we sort out. After that, we roast the beans. It's a very delicate roast, and we roast in an oven that we got from a restaurant called Marlowe & Sons, which is sort of a community hub for food artisans. And we just traded it for chocolate. So it's just really awesome to live in a community where that's possible.
To barter.
Yeah, exactly. After that, we crack all of the beans by hand. We took an old piece of an old grinder or mill that is commonly used for breaking up barley when you're making home brew, when you're making beer. Then we have to separate the husk from the bean. So we collaborated with a friend of ours who has a business in Red Hook. He's actually an engineer, like an aerospace engineer. So in his, you know, in his side project, while he's building equipment for satellites, he's just a young guy like us, you know, that's up to no good, you know. So he is collaborating with us to build this winnower, and by winnower I mean a contraption that separates the husk from the meat of the bean, and it's beautiful. After that, you have the cocoa nibs. So,
and the nibs are what are inside the husks.
Absolutely, yep. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis, the foundation of all chocolate. So we have these beautiful granite stone grinders, which is basically a mechanized version of the old way that people may have seen in encyclopedias or books of Mayan women are putting have a granite roller over a granite stone, and they're just going over the chocolate and combining it with cane sugar or vanilla bean. Large commercial companies use stainless steel, and we just find that the stainless steel will basically almost burn out the flavor. So we do a slow 3-day grinding process. Then we add the sugar. We have a very specific sugar philosophy. Each bean gets treated with a different sugar just for flavor, to construct like perfect flavor profiles.
When you say each bean, you're saying each bean from a country.
Right, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, or each varietal. Our mentality is that, for instance, Madagascar has a very sort of citrusy, almost like a sour cherry flavor to it, a little bit of a raisin flavor to it, kind of winey. And I love that acidic pure, clean flavor of it, and I don't want to disrupt it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you necessarily need to use that raw sugar is always going to be the perfect pairing. So in this case, we use something that's a little bit more refined, something that provides sweetness, but not a lot of distracting flavor.
Walk me through the process of coming up with the name for your company. Were you considering anything else?
I think it was pretty, we knew it right away.
I've taken some business classes and in the food industry, business classes and stuff like that. And they would always say, you know, whatever you do, don't involve your name in the company, because if it goes down, you don't want your name to go down with it. There's no accountability or responsibility for anything. So that is what I think is so important about calling our company Mast Brothers Chocolate and really taking the responsibility of being the face of it. The Mast Brothers has other more personal and intimate implications, and that's that our father and my uncle, they're always known as the Mast Brothers, and they used to just raise hell in their small town in Primgar, Iowa. And they're infamously the Mast Brothers, you know, much to their now ex-wife's dismay. So I think that we also wanted to get back that name.
Talk to me a little bit about the dynamic of working with family. When you were first starting out, for example, did you know how you would get along?
On the subway ride over here, my brother and I were talking about what really is it about working with family that draws you together? And what we came up with that you will never fight for anybody harder than a family member, and you will never fight harder with anybody but a family member.
Well, we had been living together for a few years before we even took on this venture or even had a notion that we'd be starting a chocolate company together. But we had that time of about 3 or 4 years of having many fights, you know, not just mental fights, physical fights. And you know, we got through those, and we still have those on occasion.
Is there a theme to the nature of your fighting?
We don't fight over what we say to each other more so than the way we talk to each other and the tone of how we talk to each other. And
it's always the tone. It's just the tone.
And then that just brings up, you know, past arguments or fights that we need to steer clear of.
And of course, it's always his tone that's wrong, not mine.
Definitely always Rick's tone.
Because we know that we've survived so much, like, together, just growing up, and also just we've lived through arguing about way worse things than a chocolate company. Mm-hmm. So if we've survived that, we can survive anything. But that also opens the door to more arguments, mm-hmm. because if you think about the psychology of that, if you know somebody that you work closely with, that you know that you're going to live to see another day, no matter how you treat them, you might take advantage of that sometimes.
Right, because you know you'll never lose them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we cross the line more often than we should. And
welcome to therapy on NPR.
Exactly.
And also, we just had some extreme successes. We are now the restaurant Per Se is using our chocolate. And
Per Se is one of the leading restaurants in New York City. Mm-hmm.
And we have such respect for Thomas Keller and his crew that to me, coming from that from a restaurant background, is like a dream come true. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, and we're so busy now that we used to be able to celebrate each of these new things that happened. So a couple of years ago, we would, celebrate
after selling 30 bars at an artist market,
like we did, really, you know. And so now we have these beautiful new things that are happening, and we don't have any time to celebrate them because we have the next thing to do, and that really takes a toll. You know, you never just get to breathe and just, oh, that was nice. You know,
do you have any grand visions for what you'd like the company to become? Or are you taking it more on a kind of incremental basis?
Definitely an incremental basis. It's that we've been very dedicated to that and are sticklers to that, because already we've had many, many opportunities to grow super fast and build a huge factory off-site somewhere and all this kind of stuff. And we've deliberately turned it down. When we first started, we were very dedicated to slow growth. Just like food should be made slowly, with care, a company should be built under the same manner.
It's kind of like your beards.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Slow growth. Yeah. Slightly annoying and hard to deal with it many times. It's, yeah, it is like a beard.
It's my impression that the way you are living is very close to the way that you want to live. Is that an accurate depiction or impression that I get from you just based on the company that you're building and the website and just my interaction with you, that there's less of a distance between the way you're living and the way you want to live?
I think so. I think that's definitely accurate. I think that part of that might be just the way we grew up, being very content with what you have and appreciative of what you have. You know, we never summered anywhere. We never even heard of the word summering. So we've never desired anything like that, you know. So there's an appreciation for, A, for hard work, for working hard. And so since we're doing that, then we're pretty content. We were joking. I was joking with Stephanie, who works with us, about how I was telling her how I've organized. I just finished organizing my pantry with my wife, and everything is like in these nice mason jars. Everything is divided up by, like, you know, grains, pasta, all this stuff. And so she started thinking, wow, so your life is, you're making chocolate, then you go home with your wife and you like look through your beautiful pantry of old timey mason jars and all of this stuff. And I said, I had to stop her. I'd be like, whoa, wait. It's not, we'll, you know, we get Chinese food with the best of them. You know what I mean? When we're exhausted. So, you know, we have cable TV, you know? So.
Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
My guests have been Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.